Before we get to our special guest, I want to follow up real briefly on what I was talking about last week at the end of Gaza Corner, which was the San Francisco supervisors voting 8-3 for a sustainable ceasefire in Gaza. And San Francisco is the largest city to date to do that. Mayor Breed did not like it, and she slammed it in very strong language, but she declined to veto it. She did not veto it. She said, quote, "Vetoing it would likely lead to yet more divisive, harmful hearings, which in turn would keep this matter and divisiveness front and center in our city and fan even more anti-Semitic acts. I cannot watch us divide ourselves even more. A leader, like a doctor, should be guided by the basic ethos to do no harm, to not make a bad situation worse. The Board of Supervisors has put us in this terrible position, and unfortunately, after much consideration and prayer, the best thing I can do is try to quell it, try to turn down the volume, and begin the healing. I must choose unity." She went on to say what happened at the Board of Supervisors during this last month did not reflect our values. While I support the need for community members to be heard, the process at the board only inflamed division and hurt. Many outside San Francisco do not draw the distinction between 8 district supervisors and the official view of San Francisco. So let me be clear, what happened at the Board of Supervisors does not speak for or on behalf of the entire city. I don't think any statement of resolution can do that. Our people do that. Our values do that. And the supervisor who really made the resolution pass by compromising some language, Aaron Peskin, said, quote, "I'm glad she didn't veto it, but I'm sorry she further divided our community and put people on all sides of this issue through more uncertainty and trauma by playing craven politics with it for another week." You may recall in mid-October, just a week into Israel's counterattack in Gaza, there was a poll that showed 2/3 of Americans supported a ceasefire. And you have to believe, I have to believe, that now, so many thousands of deaths later, indiscriminate deaths, that percentage is way higher. And I would also think it's the case in San Francisco. It's my opinion that Mayor Breed is the one who is not in sync with the values of the people she says she represents. And now I'd like to introduce Gershon Baskin. Gershon, are you there?
I am here.
Cool. So it is morning in Jerusalem. It's about 9:05 in the morning. Thank you for making yourself available. I really greatly appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And what really was the impetus was you blog a lot. You have a regular blog on the Times of Israel, a newspaper in Israel, and you had a very simple titled blog, but I found it extremely interesting and provocative. And it was Q&A on the hostage issue. And before we dig into it, I think it's important for people to know your background, because I didn't know until I did some reading that it was your family, really your first cousin, who had been kidnapped by Hamas and killed, that really put you on this path to doing all you can always to try to enable prisoner exchanges with Hamas in Gaza. You want to just go back in time and talk about that?
Sure. Well, first of all, it's my wife's first cousin. My wife is an Iraqi Jew. One of her first cousins, Sasson Nouriel, was abducted and eventually murdered by Hamas. For those who don't know, I've been living in Israel for 45 years, going on 46 now, The entire time that I've been here, I've been working across boundaries between Israelis and Palestinians, Jews and Palestinian citizens of Israel, in all kinds of peace-building efforts, both at one time in my early career working for the government and then establishing an institute for education for Jewish-Arab coexistence. And at the break of the First Intifada, establishing a joint Israeli-Palestinian public policy think tank and do tank, as we called it, IPCRI, the Israel-Palestine Center for Research and Information, which I co-directed with a Palestinian colleague for 24 years. When my wife's first cousin was abducted, I was actually working on a conference that we were running in Switzerland on the future of Jerusalem with Israelis, Palestinians, and others. And members of the family called my wife and said, maybe Gershon can help find Sasson. He disappeared. They think he went to Ramallah with a Palestinian worker in his factory. He had a candy factory. They knew that a factory in Ramallah, according to what this worker said, had been closed down and the equipment was for sale. And Sasson went to Ramallah and the Palestinian Authority areas and never came home. I tried to use my contacts, my Palestinian partner in Jerusalem, Hanna Senora, went to Ramallah and couldn't find anything. A few days later, they publicized a videotape of him. He had been handcuffed and blindfolded. He was tortured. And he read out a statement in Arabic declaring that Israel should release Palestinian prisoners for his life. A few days later, the Israeli security found his body on the side of a road in the West Bank. At his funeral, I promised myself, standing over his grave, that if ever again something like this happened, I'd do everything possible. A couple of months later, I met for the first time after 20 years of working with Palestinians, someone from Hamas. He was a professor of economics at the Islamic University. We got to talk at a conference in Cairo. I proposed to him that we organize a dialogue between Israelis and Hamas people. He agreed to the idea and we tried to do it. Make a long story short, after visiting Gaza, talking to his colleagues, understanding that the leadership of Hamas had to agree it, we got one of the leaders of Hamas to agree to participate. But in the end, the exiled leadership of Hamas in Damascus at the time vetoed it. Anyway, we developed a kind of understanding between the two of us on the need to talk. I invited him to a conference of Israelis and Palestinians that we did in Istanbul. He came to that. And then on June 26th, I believe it was 2006, Hamas attacked an Israeli army base on the Gaza-Israel border, Kerem Shalom, in the south of the Gaza Strip. They killed two soldiers, they wounded another, and took him as a hostage into Gaza. A week later, after Israel had been bombing Gaza for a week, trying to prevent the exiting of the soldier from the Gaza Strip in a military operation, hopefully to convince Hamas to return him, this professor called me and said, Gershon, we have to do something. I said, what can we do? He said, let's try to open up a channel of communication. He went to the Prime Minister's office. They called me an hour later, and that began 17 years so far of negotiating with Hamas. That the negotiations that I ran not only led to the first proof of life that Gilad Shalit was alive 2.5 months after he was abducted, but after 5 years, it finally became the official back channel direct negotiations between Israel and Hamas that led to the breakthrough that enabled Gilad Shalit to come back after 5 years and 4 months in captivity and released 1,027 Palestinian prisoners from Israel, including Yahya Sinwar, who's the leader of Hamas in Gaza and the person, one of the people directly responsible for the attack against Israel on October 7th.
And also, four of the Hamas members who killed your wife's first cousin, one of whom I believe was recently killed in Gaza.
Yeah, at the beginning of the war, he was also killed. He was a West Bank Palestinian who, according to the deal for the release of the 1,027 prisoners, he was one of the people exiled to the Gaza Strip. He became a Gaza Ezzedine Qassam, the fighting wing of Hamas, one of their commanders. And in the first days of the war, he was killed by Israel.
So let's fast forward to Israel's greatest hostage problem that it's ever had in terms of numbers. And in your Q&A, I was kind of curious, did you actually get all these questions from readers, or did you make up the questions, or is it a mix, or what?
Look, I've been dealing with this issue for so long. People ask me questions all the time. Some of them are questions, some of them are attacks. I know the Israeli mindset. I pretty much know how Israelis across the political spectrum think. And in putting forward the deal that I believe is the only deal possible to bring all the hostages home alive, I thought to myself, what am I going to be asked when I talk about this? What are the questions that are going to bother people about the possibility of making the deal? It's not comprehensive, and the last sentence of the blog is actually a call on people to ask me questions, additional questions that I might have missed. But I think I pretty much covered the main questions that people have when they talk about a possible deal of the extent that I put down on paper.
Well, you have your own idea of what a deal should look like, but Hamas has put a deal on the table. So why don't we start there? What is the deal that Hamas has put on the table that Israel will not agree to?
Well, I'll tell you what the Hamas had been saying since the beginning of the war, and the evolution of that demand was from the beginning, they said that they wanted Israel to free every single Palestinian prisoner in Israel. In fact, this is a promise that Yahya Sinwar made on the day that he was released on October 18th, 2011, and has made in every important speech he's given over the past 12 years. That was their demand from very early on in the war. I knew then that the war effort was primary importance to Israel, and they would not negotiate a deal. But I saw that there was low-hanging fruit in that there were, I think, unexpectedly by Hamas, taken a large number of young women, children's, infants, elderly people, sick and wounded. So I looked for the low-hanging fruit deal. I immediately checked, this is day two or day three of the war, checked how many women prisoners and how many teenage prisoners there were in Israel, and I discovered that the number was reasonable. There were 190 teenagers, there were 39 women. All of them were from the West Bank, none were from Gaza. There were no important Hamas people amongst them. None of them had killed Israelis. So from day three or four of the war, I was already sending messages to the Qataris, the Egyptians, people in the war cabinet in Israel, and to people in Hamas that this was a deal that should go through. It should have been done in the second week of the war, but the Israeli belief that the pressure of the military, the war effort would push Hamas to make a deal. It actually, for those who know, and very few people know, even though I've said this many times, it actually postponed that first deal by at least 2 weeks. It could have been done 2 weeks earlier. And unfortunately, it only included women and children, and it didn't include all the women and all the children. It did not include elderly, sick and wounded. And as I said, this whole group, there's about 19 young women between the ages of 20 to 30 who are held in captivity. The Israelis believe deeply that these women have been very badly sexually abused, and that's one of the reasons why Hamas did not release them in the first round of the deal. If that's true, then it's likely that they will never be released, and God forbid. I hope that's not true. But it seemed to me after that deal was done, and then Hamas actually tried to violate the terms of the deal by, instead of including women and children, tried to include the bodies of dead hostages and some elderly people. Israel made a grave mistake, I think, by breaking the ceasefire and continuing the war effort, claiming that Hamas breached the deal. This was a very silly thing to do, because Israel should have been willing to take any hostage that Hamas was willing to give on the same terms that exist before. And even if they increased the demand, they were taking three Palestinian prisoners for every Israeli hostage. Even if they demanded five or 10, it's irrelevant. Israel should have taken every hostage if possible. When that happened, I started talking to people amongst the hostage families and in the Israeli government that the Israelis needed to stop being passive and responding to Hamas demands and needed to make its own offer. And what I had proposed is an exchange for all the civilian hostages, which would include all the women, the children that were remaining there, the elderly, the sick, and the wounded. Israel would release 3,000 Palestinian prisoners. I suggested that Israel publish all the names of the prisoners in the Arab media so that Palestinian families would see their loved ones' names on a list, and this would create internal pressure. That was not done.
Let me ask you something real quick, though. When you say 3,000, as far as I know, more than 3,000 Palestinians have been arrested since October 7th.
Sure.
And prior to that, there were like at least 5,000 prisoners.
That's right. I estimate that there are about 10,000 Palestinian prisoners today in Israel. They include 559 people who are serving life sentences for murdering Israelis, some of them serving multiple life sentences for killing many Israelis. There are another 130 of the fighters who crossed into Israel on October 7th and brutally murdered Israelis on that day. There are hundreds of Hamas and Islamic Jihad fighters who have been arrested in Gaza, taken prisoner, and brought into Israel. And the estimation is that between 4,000 and 5,000 Palestinians have been arrested in the West Bank since the beginning of the war. But I thought that 3,000 was a significant number, and it would be difficult for Hamas to say no to. What I was looking for was taking the words of the Godfather, finding a deal that they would have a difficulty saying no to.
But Hamas values the prisoners who have been in there the longest and the ones who are on life sentences, the ones that have been...
That's for sure, but if we were talking about an interim deal and not an all-for-all deal, then my concern was getting the civilians out of Gaza, the hostages. And for that, I thought that a large number of prisoners, without specifying who they are, I mean, Israel would publish a list. I was telling the Israelis that they had to include within that list some of the people serving life sentences, not necessarily the biggest ones that Hamas are most interested in, but Hamas would not make a deal without some serving life sentences. But the majority would not be those prisoners who are deemed by Israel to be the worst criminals and the most danger to Israel. Nonetheless, it didn't go anywhere. No one picked it up. Then Hamas changed the terms of what it was demanding about a month ago, and started talking about a cessation of the war, an end to the war, and Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, and only then would they begin negotiating on the hostage deal. And that, of course, was a non-starter for Israel. So a few weeks ago, I started putting messages out to the Qataris, the Egyptians, and asked them to check with Hamas. I was getting some answers back from Hamas through the Qataris and the Egyptians, and I decided to write a proposal and send it directly to some Hamas people. Basically, the proposal was that rather than wasting time, the proposal was that the war would end, Israel would withdraw, and then immediately there would be an exchange of all for all that would take place over the period of a few days. And there were a lot of questions that would be asked about that deal. For one, this is certainly a surrender by Israel to Hamas. For two, in my view, it's also dangerous that Hamas come out victorious from this war. It's dangerous for Gaza. It's dangerous for the West Bank. It's dangerous for Israel. It's dangerous for Jordan and maybe other countries in the region. And therefore, it was clear to me that with a victory like this of Hamas, it had to be a short-lived victory. So we needed to think about the day after the hostages are released as well, and what needs to be done or what could be done by Israel after the war is finished, hostages home, and then Hamas emerges from the tunnels, is celebrating his victory.
Well, I need to follow up. So give me a moment here. Getting back to the 3,000, I want to make it clear, because you really pointed out that many of them, from your information, were Islamic Jihad and from the Qassam Brigades in Gaza. But there were many, many, many who were just arbitrarily detained as bargaining chips, who were either...
No, I don't think so. I think that people who were arrested, particularly over the last 3 months of the war, are people who are... A majority of them are connected to Hamas in one way or another in the West Bank. And the big fear of Israel is that the war could easily... move from the Gaza Strip to the West Bank, and this would open up another front. So I personally think that Israel is engaging in policies in the West Bank that will lead to an explosion if they're not changed. I wrote about this in the blog a couple of weeks ago, that the West Bank is on the verge of exploding. This will continue if Israel continues to doing this. American pressure on Israel to make some of the changes that are necessary, it was just agreed by Israel to transfer most of the taxation money that Israel collects on behalf of the Palestinian Authority. Some other steps have been taken to ease some of the movement internally within the West Bank, the army is beginning to talk more and more about the realization that the West Bank is on the verge of explosion. So I don't think people are being held as bargaining chips, although in fact, that's what they are.
No,
and people are being held, are suspected of doing things against the Israeli occupation. Look, the root cause of all of this is the Israeli occupation. And as long as there is the occupation, Israel will not have security and the Palestinians will not have freedom and dignity. And it goes both ways. The Palestinians will never have freedom and dignity if Israel doesn't have security. We have a two-way street here that the two sides eventually have to get back in the region with the international community, figuring out how 7 million Palestinian Arabs and 7 million Israeli Jews are going to share this land between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. That's what it will come down to at the end of the day.
Our guest on Gaza Corner this morning in Jerusalem and tonight here in San Francisco is Gershon Baskin, who really, without you, Galit Shalit would not have been released in 2011 after 5 years and 4 months. And, I mean, it's pretty much been your mission ever since to try to enable these prisoner exchanges. And also wrote a book called The Negotiator that is available, that we have a link to it at Amazon, The Negotiator Freeing Gilad Shalit from Hamas. You also wrote a blog on November 18th called Negotiations for Hostages. I found it curious why you did it. It was basically the transcript of all your texting and conversations with your Hamas contact, Ghazi Hamad. I found it interesting, but it was curious that you did that. So hold on, though, before you address that. I do want to say that from the reading that I've done, Gershon, and I'm of the belief that literally thousands of Palestinians in the West Bank have been arrested, and many on flimsy charges. And of course, many are also in prison with no charge, administrative detention, which can be renewed every 6 months and go on and on and on. So I don't really look at some of these as all of them as prisoners. I think some of them are hostages, essentially. And Israel can just go back and rearrest people that they release. And I think that, as you said earlier, Hamas is probably not likely to agree to anything unless it's all or nothing, especially at this point. Or do you think that that is off base?
No, look, I wrote this. I said that the only deal that will bring all the hostages home alive now is an end to the war, an Israeli withdrawal of the Gaza Strip to the international border, and a release of all Palestinian prisoners in exchange for all hostages. This, I believe, is the only possible deal that would bring all the hostages home alive.
But you also said, which I thought was the most provocative part of your blog, was that, and I'll quote, ending the war and withdrawing from Gaza does not eliminate the possibility of Israel renewing the war the day after the hostages are returned.
That's right. Listen, the war can wait. Anyone who wants to destroy Hamas and kill Yahya Sinwar and Mohammed Deif and Marwan Issa and any of the leadership there, they can wait. Israel hasn't done it since they came to power 17 years ago. The hostages cannot wait. The hostages are being killed every day, either by Israeli bombs or by Hamas murderers. The hostages cannot wait another day. The war effort can wait, and this is the message to the Israelis. You're hot and you're angry and you want revenge and you want to remove Hamas. Fine. That can wait. The hostages cannot wait.
So you're saying that, okay, get all the hostages home and then continue the genocide in Gaza and keep killing thousands upon thousands with dumb bombs and indiscriminate bombing that has literally killed probably now about 30,000, including people under rubble. 70% of them are women and children, 40% overall are children. That's your answer?
Listen, I don't want to get into an argument over the term genocide or the numbers of people killed. There are war crimes being committed by Israel in Gaza. I accept that. And I think that the Israeli war effort is being waged in the wrong way. I think that it would be a tragedy if Hamas comes out of this war still in power and still in control of Gaza. It would be a tragedy for the Palestinian people and for the future of the region, not only for Israel. So I am being totally realistic. I don't believe that at the end of this war, whenever it ends, that Gaza should continue to be Hamastan. For the same token, Israel can no longer continue to be Bibistan. We need new leadership in this area, in Israel and in Palestine. And there's no doubt that the Palestinian people deserve much better leaders than the ones that they've had, both in the West Bank and Gaza. The Palestinian leadership needs to be united over one territory. And we need to get away from this nonsense of the international community talking about a two-state solution while they only recognize one of the states. So I'm encouraged that, in fact, there is a new chance of a political movement after this war that the international community will be serious about, that will force Israel to end the occupation and lead to the creation of a Palestinian state, which, quite honestly, I think that most of us believe the two-state solution was no longer viable. In a very bizarre way, the victory of Hamas is putting the two-state solution back on the agenda locally and internationally, and it's something that the Hamas doesn't even support. But Hamas cannot continue to rule Gaza and rule over the Palestinian people and be victorious. So the big challenge is, how do you return the hostages? How do you eliminate Hamas's ability to govern Gaza and threaten Israel without killing a lot of people and committing war crimes? There are ways of doing it. They're very difficult. It's not only through the gun, but also by empowering Palestinians who want political change to become the leaders of the Palestinian people. This will happen in a number of stages, probably, before they can have open, free, and fair democratic elections and elect their own leaders who they want. But we all have a responsibility in the United States and in this region, in particular Egypt and Jordan and the Saudis and the Emiratis and the Bahrainis and, of course, Israel, and the Palestinian people, to figure out how to move forward once we resolve the issue with the hostages, once we enable a new plan for reconstructing Gaza and allowing people to live a decent life there, enabling Palestinians to have freedom and dignity and Israelis to have security. It's all complex. And there are no easy solutions here. And simply labeling something genocide doesn't resolve anything, or with all due respect to the supervisors of the city of San Francisco, no one in Israel or Palestine even heard about that vote, and yet you all think it's very important.
Well, let me say this. First of all, the American people and Congress and Biden, I think there's a real disconnect, and that's par for the course. But I think a majority of Americans actually do want a ceasefire. Polls have indicated that. I'll say this about genocide. We don't have to get bogged down on it. I mean, although, you know, Holocaust scholars like Ross Siegel and Omer Bartov they've either said it's genocide or the threshold of committing genocide. But more importantly, I'll point to an article by Haaretz columnist Gedeon Levy, who had a headline, "If it isn't a genocide in Gaza, then what is it?" Quote, "Let us assume that Israel's position at The Hague is right and just, and Israel committed no genocide or anything close to it. So what is this? What do you call the mass killing without discrimination, without restraint, on a scale that is difficult to imagine?" And when you say, Gershon, that get all the hostages back, empty the Israeli prisons of Palestinians, and then go back into Gaza and try everything you can to remove Hamas, which even some of the most reputable former generals in Israel say you cannot defeat Hamas. You cannot make it disappear. They're more popular now than ever.
Well, I didn't say make Hamas disappear. In fact, I've written many, many times that the only way to challenge the idea of Hamas, you beat the ideas by having better ideas. And the better idea of Hamas, which has sanctified dying for Palestine, dying for Al-Aqsa, dying for Al-Quds, is to enable Palestinian people to begin to live for Palestine, to live for Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa. And that means making Palestine real. I think one of my columns was in fact called Making Palestine Real. And that requires things like the United States immediately recognizing the Palestinian state, along with the other OECD nations, granting Palestine membership in the United Nations as a full state member of the United Nations. That automatically transitions the conflict from Israel occupying the Palestinian territories into Israel, a member state of the United Nations, occupying another state of the United Nations. It removes the Israeli veto from the question of Palestinian statehood from the negotiating table and turns it into a state-to-state negotiation on issues of border, on economic issues, on Jerusalem, on refugees, on all the other issues that have to be negotiated. But there's no reason why the international community should continue to allow Israel to have a veto on the creation of a Palestinian state.
But what is the state?
Challenge Hamas and defeat Hamas by providing the Palestinians with the realization that they could actually have freedom and dignity.
Well, you're still advocating going back in after all the hostages are exchanged.
I didn't advocate going back in.
Yes, you did. Right on your blog. In your blog, I read it word for word.
What I said is that those people who believe that the military way is to end Hamas can go back in. There's nothing in a deal to release the hostages that would prevent Israel from going back into Gaza. There are people who have said things, well, they'll demand international guarantees. Let's get real. What kind of international guarantee is anyone from anywhere going to give Hamas that Israel will not re-enter Gaza and try to eliminate Hamas's military command or its ability to govern? That can be done militarily, by the way, removing Hamas's ability to govern and Hamas's military ability to threaten Israel. Hamas cannot be gotten rid of through the military. The idea of Hamas, the ideology of Hamas has to be challenged both within Palestine, in the Arab world, in the Muslim world, and by Israel ending the occupation and granting the Palestinians a chance for a decent life with dignity and freedom.
What kind of state are you envisioning? What territory?
We're talking about a Palestinian state based on the 67 borders of the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem as its capital. I believe that there needs to be very, very deep and wide cross-boundary cooperation with free movement between the two territories. People who know the model of two states, one homeland, have looked at the possibilities of residency, which is different from citizenship, the kind of European model where a Polish citizen can live in Germany and work in Germany and have all the benefits of living in Germany, but vote in the Polish parliament. There are all kinds of federation and confederation models that can be developed, which are all based on the basic concept that there would be a territory under Israeli sovereignty and another territory under Palestinian sovereignty. And those territories are within the boundaries of the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea.
How do you enforce 1967 borders when the reality on the ground is that everywhere you look in the West Bank, settlements are ubiquitous? You're going to have them be withdrawn like happened in Gaza in 2005? I mean, I don't understand.
First of all, about 80% of the settlers and settlements can be, 80% of the settlers can be included within sovereign areas of Israel in a territorial swap of lands, one-to-one, between territory in the West Bank and territory within Israel along the both the West Bank and the Gaza borders. There are big maps that are drawn up to enable that. The hardcore settlements, which are the most difficult, we're talking about 80,000 people in the heartland of the West Bank, would either have to agree to live under Palestinian sovereignty, which is very unlikely, in non-segregated communities, which is probably very unlikely, or Israel will have to give a date when they will no longer have protection by Israel, and they will have to make a decision to come back to sovereign Israel, either in the parts of Judea and Samaria, as they call it, that would be annexed to Israel, or within the sovereign state of Israel proper. But these will have to be done based on a timeline and based on all kinds of benchmarks and based on guaranteeing that the two parties actually implement the obligations they take upon themselves. Because in the open-ended Oslo process that did not happen, Israel and Palestine signed six agreements and then systemically breached all six of those agreements. Both sides did. They did not implement what they obligated themselves to do. So we need to start this process at a zero or a negative basis of trust between the two sides. And then a process has to be built based on verifiable benchmarks of implementation, verified by a trusted third-party monitoring and verifying a mechanism that will enable the sides to take additional risks as we move forward, building trust based on the actual doing what we say we're going to do.
You said before that there can be no guarantees on any deal because, you know, it's just not realistic. But all of a sudden now you're saying that...
No, I said there could be no guarantees to Hamas that Israel would not attack Gaza. Those are two very different things. In peace processes around the world, in fact, the entire US-USSR arms control agreements were based on third-party verifiers and monitors that the two parties were in fact dismantling nuclear bombs. That's the kind of model that can be, that has been used in other peace processes around the world and will have to be used here, because we have no basis to believe each other when we say we're going to implement something, because we don't.
Netanyahu has said that Palestinian state, which he's dead opposed to, could not be a sovereign state. They could not have their own military. What kind of nation state is that then?
Well, first of all, I would suggest that Netanyahu and a Palestinian state are incompatible. If there is going to be a Palestinian state, it's going to mean that Netanyahu is no longer controlling Israel, which I think is the likely, most likely outcome of this war. Netanyahu and his cronies will have their day of reckoning with the Israeli people, and the National Investigation Committee that will be formulated and headed by a Supreme Court judge to determine the failures of Israel in protecting itself. And of course, that has to do with the policies of Netanyahu of rejecting any chance of peace with Palestinians on the basis of Palestinian state. Palestinians in negotiations over 20 years of negotiations have agreed to a non-militarized state. There are Palestinians that recognize that the threats to Israel are genuine from some of the neighboring states, and therefore some element of external security of Israel and Palestine would be remain in the hands of Israel. These issues are all to be negotiated by the Palestinians, and they should achieve a state where they have maximum sovereignty. But understanding in the world that, as an old friend of mine used to say, sovereignty ain't what it used to be. Every country of the world that's a member of an international organization, a member of the United Nations, signs on to an international convention, voluntarily gives up part of their sovereignty. Sovereignty in the modern world is not having absolute, total, free control over everything you do. It actually means being part of an international community where there are limitations on the ability of states to do everything that it wants to do. So Palestine will be another member state of the United Nations. It will be member state 194, which is maybe somewhat significant given that UN Resolution 194 is the resolution that Palestinians, quote, is granting them the right of return for refugees. So there's an interesting symbolism here. But nonetheless, Palestine will be a member state of the international community in the future, and it will negotiate with Israel, with the region, and the rest of the world to the kind of international relations that it will have, making the kind of decisions that it wants to make on behalf of the people that elected its government, who are the Palestinian people, and they will have to determine who their leaders are and what kind of state they want.
If you're talking about new leaders, one who is mentioned a lot, who is in prison, and who is also mentioned a lot in terms of a prisoner exchange, is Marwan Barghouti. Are you a believer that he can unify the factions in Palestine and be an effective leader?
Yeah, I wrote a piece about this many times. I know Marwan quite well. I've been in contact with him through his lawyer. Over the past 22 years that he's been in prison, I have tried to encourage the Israeli security leadership to enter into dialogue with Marwan, because I think the best for Israel and the Palestinian people would be if Marwan would be released as part of a political deal with Israel. That's not happening yet. I don't think it would be very good for Marwan to be released in a deal with Hamas, but nonetheless, that might happen. Marwan is the most popular Palestinian leader. He is consistently is selected in Palestinian public opinion polls over the last two decades as the person most likely to beat every other Palestinian candidate. I know that Marwan still believes in the two-state solution. He still believes that the best way to get there is through negotiations with Israel. He still believes that Palestinians have the right to an armed struggle if there is no negotiated path to negotiations. I would hope that he would declare that they would not use an armed struggle against Israel, but would demand an internationally supported political process that would bring about the end of the Israeli occupation. Marwan does not make public statements, and he's one of those politicians who knows that his height of popularity will begin to diminish the minute he begins speaking. So Marwan, even though most of the time he's been in prison, he has been able to make public statements. They could have gotten out through his family or through his lawyer. In the last 3 months of the war, he's been in solitary confinement, and he has only been allowed to meet with his lawyer once. In fact, there was a court case on Thursday this past week to grant him rights for visits both from his lawyer and his family. He's not the only Palestinian prisoner who's being denied those rights now, and this needs to be challenged in the courts in Israel, because I believe what they're doing is illegal. Anyway, Marwan is a significant player, and if there were, when there will be free, fair elections in Palestine, he is very likely to be elected, whether he's in prison or not. And I think from Israel's point of view, having a Palestinian president elected while he's in prison is going to be very uncomfortable for Israel.
Our guest on Gaza Corner is Gershon Baskin, who wrote the book The Negotiator, which tells the story of the prisoner swap of Gilad
Shalit
in 2011, after 5 years and 4 months. And Baskin played a critical role in making that happen and has never stopped trying to make prisoner releases and also trying to coexist both with Palestinians and Israelis.
And I think more important than that book actually is a point your listeners to another book that was published about 3 years ago by Vanderbilt University Press called In Pursuit of Peace in Israel and Palestine. It's published in hard copy, in soft copy, in electronic version, as well as an audio book. And it actually includes about 38 years of insights, of understandings, of stories, of the journey that I've taken in trying to figure out how to make peace between Israel and Palestine, looking at a lot of the mistakes that we made in trying to learn lessons from those mistakes and offering ideas on how we could actually do it better.
I want to get back to your point about Marwan Barghouti, who says he doesn't eliminate the possibility of armed struggle. But I want to underscore that that is a resolution that was passed by the UN General Assembly. That was in December of 1982, is Resolution 37/43. Quote, it reaffirmed the legitimacy of the struggle of peoples for independence, territorial integrity, national unity, and liberation from colonial and foreign domination and foreign occupation by all available means, including armed struggle. And that leads me to a question that a listener emailed me. His name is Eric Broke. He says, can you envision a way nonviolent resistance can be effective at this point in Gaza or in Israel?
Yeah, I wish that there was. I wish there were a Palestinian Martin Luther King or Nelson Mandela or someone, or Mahatma Gandhi, who would lead the Palestinians to a nonviolent struggle. I've written probably 10 articles that have been published in Arabic and Palestinian newspapers calling for what I call the policy of non-cooperation with the occupation. It's a very costly endeavor on behalf of Palestinians who have to be willing to undertake the ramifications of that. It begins, for example, with Palestinians burning their identification cards and numbers, which are issued by the Palestinian Authority, but in coordination with the Israeli government. The first mechanism of control of an occupied people is the control of the population registry, which Israel does. And if Palestinians were to issue new ID cards to every Palestinian with numbers that are not the same numbers that Israel gave them, it would set the occupation into chaos. But it would also mean that Palestinians could not get work permits in Israel, could not get travel permits. Their passports and travel documents would not be recognized. It would require great suffering. And that was just one of 20 different ideas that I put down on paper calling for the non-cooperation with the occupation. It's something that had the Palestinians done years ago, I think that they would be living in freedom today. It is a very difficult thing to do when there really lacks the leadership to direct people in that way. I think, though, that what we're going to see, hopefully, and I hope it's not just wishful thinking on my part, is that the international community is going to be much more serious now in taking Israel to task to end the occupation and forcing the Palestinian people to also recognize that they have to live in peace next to Israel, not in place of Israel. All these slogans, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, negate the possibility that Palestine will be free, because there is no solution which is going to lead to the removal of Israel. They're going to have to find a way of living in two states, in a two-state reality, where there is mutual recognition, mutual respect, and cooperation between the two states. The only way that a one-state solution might emerge in the future is if these two people, at some point of living in peace for decades or generations, decide that that's what they want. But there is no way of reaching that now, without the international community imposing it on the reality that we have here, which means forcing Israel to end the occupation and forcing the Palestinians to really recognize Israel's existence and right to exist, and getting these parties to the table, not a bilateral table, but a regional and an international table. We need much more stability and security and economic development possibilities for the Palestinians and the reconstruction of Gaza than can ever be done bilaterally. So we really need the United States to take the lead here. The Saudis are going to be engaged in a very, very strong way, and that's very important. The Palestinian leadership is going to have to make peace with the Emiratis, who broke the Arab Peace Initiative and recognized Israel, make peace with Israel. There's a lot of cooperation that can be done for the benefit of both Israel and Palestine, and it has to be done together to lead to a positive outcome of the horrific tragedies that we're seeing take place during this war.
You know, Israel's the only country, I think, in the world that, you know, in any kind of interview, the first question is, do they have a right to exist? I mean, personally, Gershon, I don't think any country has a right to exist because they all come to power in...
Yeah, I can agree with you. It's a moot argument. It's not going to convince the 7 million Israeli Jews who believe that the world is against them and they need to be recognized. This is part of our neurosis or psychosis or whatever you want to call it, 2,000 years of persecution have led the Israelis to get that recognition from the people who live in the same house. And that's what we're talking about. Yeah. You know, Israel didn't demand this recognition from Egypt or Jordan or the Emiratis or Bahrain, but it does demand it from the Palestinians because the Palestinians want to replace the Israelis, not the Egyptians and not the Jordanians.
Well, only the majority of Palestinians don't. And, you know, Rashida Tlaib, Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, went to lengths in describing why from the river to the sea Palestine will be free. It does not mean the annihilation of Israel. It's a phrase that's just fraught with people wanting to believe whatever they want to believe, but it's not what the majority of Palestinians, how they use that phrase. And
well, I think that they do. In fact, I think that they don't recognize that Israel, with a large Jewish majority, has the right to define itself as the democratic nation state of the Jewish people. Listen, I'm a member of a new political party that was established 2 years ago called All of Its Citizens, Kol Ezecheya, Kol Muataneya, which is based on the principle that Israel is a state of all of its citizens. So I believe that we need to de-Zionize the state of Israel and recognize that in order for Israel to be a true democracy, it has to be the state of all of its citizens, 21% of whom are Palestinians, and they have the full right to be equal, 100% equal citizens of this state and have this state represent them in an equal way. But I still recognize and understand the need of the Jewish people to have that recognition of their right to exist, even if it doesn't exist anywhere else in the world. We're not talking about what's right or what's wrong. We're talking about what's needed in order for there to be genuine peace. And as again, if the Palestinians want to have freedom and dignity, the Israelis have to have security. And security is not just the physical security of having a strong army. It's the security of their existence and the recognition of their existence, of their right to be here.
Again, we're listening to live from Jerusalem. I assume you're in Jerusalem.
I am.
Good. Okay. Gershon Vaskin. And, you know, the phrase from the river to the sea, I mean, I think really the phrase that we should be much more concerned about is, I'll just paraphrase the phrase, from the river to the sea, messianic settlers will reoccupy all of historic Palestine. That is happening. That is happening on steroids right now.
That's right.
In the Jordan Valley.
It is an existential threat to the existence of Israel. It is dangerous, and it is taking place, and it's taken place for far too long, and it has to end. Israel needs to recognize the Palestinian people and their right to exist and have freedom and dignity and sovereignty. It goes both ways. It's a two-way street.
We only have a few minutes left. I want to get your view about Prime Minister Netanyahu seemingly thinking that as long as he can keep this war going, and he said in a Wall Street Journal piece that he won't stop until Hamas is completely destroyed, Gaza must be demilitarized, and the Palestinian society must be de-radicalized, although I think they're doing this war on Gaza with upwards of right now about 30,000 dead and so many wounded and 85% of the population completely displaced. That to me is a recipe of radicalizing a society, not de-radicalizing.
Sure, there's no question about it. But the more Israel hits Hamas, the stronger the support of Hamas grows within Palestine.
But my question is there a scenario, a realistic scenario, that Netanyahu, who thinks he stays in office as long as the war goes on, that he can somehow make it go on until the Biden, Trump, if those are the two candidates, which it seems like they will be, face off in November, and Trump has every possibility of winning, and then Netanyahu can play Trump like a piece of putty?
Yeah, I don't have a crystal ball, but I do believe that it is true that Netanyahu wants to prolong the war as long as possible, because as long as the war is going on, there is that no investigation committee which is going to eventually hold him guilty and responsible and remove him from office. Yet what is growing stronger every day in Israel are the call for new elections. There was a large demonstration last night around the country in front of Netanyahu's house in Caesarea, in Tel Aviv, in Jerusalem. And the marches and the demonstrations for new elections are growing. In the New York Times today, I guess it is, came out last night, there is an article with two people in the know who wrote it, of senior military officers who are saying that there is a non-compatibility between the two goals of the Israeli war effort, defeating Hamas and bringing the hostages home. So there are all kinds of cracks that are happening in this wall of Bibiism, of Netanyahu supporters, breaking down the reality. We heard Gadi Eisenkot, the former chief of staff, a member of the war cabinet, one of the more moral voices within the Israeli cabinet, who gave a very long interview where he clearly stepped away from the policies of Netanyahu and also said that we need new elections. So there is a movement here in Israel. As I said, I don't believe that we will have a Bibistan in Israel in the distant future, maybe in the foreseeable future. We are coming to terms with the fact that a majority of Netanyahu's supporters no longer support him. So there is a breakdown in this myth of Netanyahu's magical ability to stay in power. I will comment when you put this against the Biden-Trump elections, that the election of Donald Trump is the most dangerous thing that can happen to the entire planet. Forget about Israel and Palestine. The damage that Donald Trump would do to the world is beyond imagination. And even Americans who don't longer support Biden because of what he's doing with Israel or any other reason should never allow Donald Trump to return to the White House. This is so important that Donald Trump never be allowed to step foot in that White House again.
Which makes it more shocking that Biden won't call for a ceasefire because he's hurting his own chances of being elected. You know,
I've suggested to the Biden administration that they should unilaterally recognize the state of Palestine and start from there.
I want to thank you for being one of the few Israelis, the only one I really know of, who has really humanized. Now, I know right now you've had a falling out with your longtime friend, Ghazi Hamad, but Netanyahu and the government is so adept and all the Hasbara at dehumanizing Palestinians, and particularly Hamas. And especially that blog that shows all the texting back and forth, really shows the humanity on both sides. You know, when you say that there's still a way to have a Palestinian state along 1967 borders with land swaps, you know, back in May of 2017, Hamas revised its charter, had a new charter, which did not oppose a state along the 1967 borders. So,
but they also said they would never recognize Israel.
And I don't think it's necessary myself. That's my opinion. I don't think it's. Okay. I think you can be at peace and not recognize South Korea.
No, they didn't talk about peace.
South Korea does not recognize North Korea. They've been at peace since 1953.
True. Anyhow, and you have the most mobilized border in the world.
Yeah,
right,
you do.
They're
a
very dangerous place. But Hamas did not talk about peace. They talked about Palestine is from the river to the sea, and they will accept now a Palestinian state in the 67 borders. without recognizing Israel or making peace with Israel. I think we can do far better than that. And I think that Hamas is very bad for the Palestinian people. I think that they have kept them under a very harsh regime in Gaza. They have changed Palestinian society in Israel. In Gaza, we have seen how they've mobilized a military force without providing food, water, and medical care for their people, houses and schools and you name it. There's no shortage of rockets and ammunition in Gaza, while there is a huge shortage of food and water and medical supplies.
Let's remind everyone that there's a 17-year blockade and siege on Gaza.
Yeah, but that blockade did not prevent them from importing weapons.
It's the longest siege.
They didn't worry about the people. They worried about themselves. They even said during this war, ironically, that they are protecting the hostages
15,
and people
15
on the
seconds,
streets of
15
Gaza.
Seconds.
People on the streets of Gaza said, why are you protecting the hostages and not protecting us? Hamas is not good for Palestine.
That is the voice of Gershon Baskin. Gershon, thank you so very much for getting up early in
You're
Jerusalem.
You're very welcome.
All right.